Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Governor Mike DeWine has ordered the State Environmental Protection Agency and Department of Health to investigate the safety of Ohio drinking water. The announcement came 4 months after a study found so-called forever chemicals in Ohio drinking water. DeWine made water a key issue in his campaign for office, and during his State of the State address in March, he promised to address the state's many water issues.
From aging infrastructure to failing septic systems to nutrient pollution, to threats of lead contamination, communities throughout Ohio face different and unique water problems.
Beth Berger covers the environment and science for the Columbus Dispatch. She joins us. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
What do we know about what inspired the governor to order that study by the Ohio EPA and the Department of Health?
Well, PFAS, it's a family of chemicals, and I don't know how much you're aware of it. It's growing a lot more attention on the national scale, and there obviously, I think there needs to be a lot more reporting at our level and other places
And PFAS stands for PFAS.
Right. So those are toxic fluorinated chemicals. And we have a lot of strong connections to this issue here in Ohio. There's been several federal court cases, some of which are still playing out in our state. Right here in Columbus at our federal courthouse, for example. I don't know if anyone's been going to the movies lately, but you'll see the previews for a movie called Dark Waters. I think it's Anne Hathaway and Mark Ruffalo who is playing this attorney who works for corporate America, and then he ends up representing this suit against DuPont about these very chemicals. And those attorneys work right here in our state, and they're actually still pursuing cases involving PFAS. So what these forever chemicals are is they're the governor, to go back to your original question, the governor said he isn't sure whether these chemicals are widespread in Ohio's water supply or not. There's certain locations where there's a good chance they could be because of this. These chemicals are used in everything from firefighting foam to fight certain types of fires to like Teflon or nonstick cookware to protective spraying and like upholstery, things like that. Maybe your outdoor rain jacket that's really slick. I mean, they're in a lot of products that we've been using for decades now.
And why are they problematic if we've been using them for decades? I mean, how could we be using them for decades and yet they're problematic?
The problem is they don't break down. These are man-made chemicals that accumulate in your blood and they stay there. And then the question becomes, at what point do you have to worry about it? So hypothetically, we all are walking around with some sort of level of these chemicals in our bloodstream because we've been around them and we've been producing them in so many products for so long. There are some health studies that are out there already that are showing from the CDC's website, you can look and there's concerns that they hinder development in children and infants. They decrease fertility in women. They interfere with the body's natural hormones, spike cholesterol levels, and affect the immune system and raise the risk for cancers. So those are a lot of health issues. That it's kind of like one of those medical ads where you see happy people and they list, you know, huge number of health effects. So there is good reason for concern and the fact that, you know, your body isn't able to pass them through and it keeps them. So that's why there's this huge conversation that we're having now at the national level as well. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency hasn't issued regulations yet, but they've issued an advisory. And that's 70 parts per trillion of certain chemicals. When we say PFAS, it's the abbreviation for it. There are PFOAs and PFOs, and it's this huge family of chemicals. And, you know, there's hundreds of them, and we haven't tested all of them. So one of the court cases going through Columbus right now with the law firm, and I'm blanking on the law firm. They're going to kill me for not being able to give them props during your show. But they are trying to get injunctive relief to actually make these companies that have used these products for years actually pay for scientific studies so we know what's going on with them. And they would have to be third-party studies and they would be overseen by our court system, our federal court system.
That's just to figure out what the situation is.
Exactly.
Because we don't know.
Well, we know what we do know, like certain narrowed chemicals in this family have been tested. And from the other ones that we've tested around those, that's where those health effects have been brought up. The concern is that all of them in that family of chemicals could show similar effects.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Ohio water today. My guest is Beth Berger. She's covers in the environment and science for the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, we'll have a couple scientists on as well to talk about this. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call. We'll get to it later in the program, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Ohio has been highlighted in this study about the PFAS. Why Ohio? I mean, are there other states as well? Are these clustered in certain kinds of states?
So states are handling this different. Like I said, the federal government hasn't issued down top-down regulations for everyone to follow. They've issued that advisory of that 70 parts per trillion. There is a growing number of health experts and researchers who are saying, actually, it needs to be way lower. So you look at a state like Michigan, who's our neighbor, and the National Wildlife Federation recently released a report looking at Great Lakes states and these chemicals and how states are handling this at a policy level. So Michigan, for example, they have standards for these types of chemicals in drinking water, surface water, groundwater and soil contamination as well. And they've taken a very aggressive approach. So you think of a situation like we had in Flint, Michigan, and that might be the reason why they are being so aggressive with this. They've set much lower standards. So instead of 70 parts per trillion in some of these chemicals, they're going down to 6, a single digit, when it comes to
cutting
drinking water.
Cutting it by almost 90%.
Yes. And we don't have any standard like that in Ohio.
So Ohio is just following the federal guidelines?
Correct.
Or do they even have to do that?
They should probably do that since it's the federal EPA.
But it's only a guideline, right?
It is a guideline, yes. So That was one of the questions I asked the governor's office when I was talking to his staff is, hey, that's great that we're studying all this, but we don't even have our own benchmarks set. You know, how are we going to tell whatever you test is good or bad? Because there's no level.
And how did they respond?
They weren't sure. Forgive me here. I'm going to flip through. I brought some materials to review, but they weren't sure regulations were going to be part or a result of this study. And that might be one of the reasons they're looking at these studies is to get a handle on it.
He wants what? The governor wants what by December 1st?
So
the study completed?
No.
Okay.
They're hoping to develop an action plan that would test public and private water systems near known sources of the chemicals. And then they're hoping to develop strategies on what to do when high levels are found. So,
and that's by December 1st they'll have that?
Yes, they're supposed to have this action plan. That's the deadline, is December 1st. So, yeah, when I asked about Ohio developing its own standards like Michigan has, mm-hmm. for example, I was told that has not been decided yet.
Hmm. Who would oppose standards?
You know, I personally don't know. I mean, you could maybe argue that some of these industrial sites that use these chemicals or companies potentially, you know, maybe they don't want that. I don't know. The only other big piece of this is that obviously this is a lot of manpower. It could result in more regulation. And we, as a state, have made the conscious choice to scale back regulations. So one of the things that was slipped into the last budget cycle bill, and this is a story that I'm trying to work on actually with some other dispatch reporters, I'm trying to coordinate coverage of this, is have you heard about the 2-for-1 regulations at the federal level with the Trump administration?
No.
Okay, so our Republicans in the General Assembly had a bill last year where they decided to, for every state agency that decided to introduce a new regulation, they have to cut 2 other ones.
Oh, I have heard. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we have that here in our state. We have a form of it. And it's not just, you know, Ohio EPA that has to deal with this. It's every state agency in Ohio that's dealing with this. They are coming up right now as we speak, and the deadline is December 31st, a list of every regulation that they have. So you could have one regulation and maybe 20 rules in it. So for those 20 rules, you have to cut 40 other ones if you introduce a new one. Do you see what I'm saying?
So yes.
If you have...
What is the logic of that?
They claim it hurts businesses. So that's why they've gone about making Ohio more business friendly. So companies don't have to get tangled with all these regulations, and it can help our economy is the argument that I'm told. But when you have a situation like these forever chemicals that we're talking about today, where there's hundreds of them, then are we going to cut hundreds of them if we decide to set
enact
levels?
Regulations right. to restrict hundreds of them?
Yeah.
You'd have to cut hundreds of other rules.
Yeah, twice the number that you come up with. Absolutely. So there's huge implications for that. And then what do you cut? Now, that's not to say that some regulations, they may be on the books from years and years ago, and maybe we don't need them. I don't know. But we don't know how they're going to go about cutting them, which ones they're going to pick. You know, it poses lots of interesting questions. Let's put it that way.
When that test that found the PFAS in Ohio water, was that in, like, the drinking water we use every day?
Let's see. Which test are you talking about? Are you talking the military sites?
The ones, the ones that spurred the governor to order the Ohio EPA and the Department of Health to investigate the safety of Ohio drinking water.
Now, I'm not sure which test that, you know, that spurred him into action. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of attention has been given to military sites, and I was just writing about that a week before that announcement. Military sites like Wright-Patterson and Army National Guard ones as well, where this firefighting foam is used,
oh, okay.
that they tend to have very high levels of it because they used it for years and then it washed and ends up seeping in. And a lot of those locations were on well water. So you can imagine how that could be problematic.
And that's at private sources of water that they're talking about, public and private. Is that kind of well water? Is that what we're talking about?
It could be either, but private. I mean, I think the private or the well water is of more concern because of how it's accessed and how water flows in terms of groundwater. So contamination would flow with that.
How is the Ohio EPA and the Department of Health working together on this? Or do we know what their roles are?
That I'm not sure yet. I have not followed up since the initial announcement to see what they're doing. They're trying to come up with a plan that's due in December, but what that plan is going to entail or involve, that I'm not completely sure of. So I'm hoping to follow up with them a little bit later to see where things stand.
Well, Beth Berger, thanks for catching us up and appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Beth Berger. She covers the environment and science for the Columbus Dispatch. We will continue our conversation about Ohio water today. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Governor Mike DeWine has made water quality a priority since taking office. During his State of the State address in March, he cautioned that a solution could take time.
Our water problems have accumulated over the years. And it is going to take a dedicated, long-term commitment to achieve real solutions to protect Ohio's water for our children and our grandchildren.
We're talking about Ohio Water Health and what it means for you today. Joining us, Heather Raymond. She's director of the Water Quality Initiative, the Ohio State College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. I'm happy to be here.
You know, Heather, a big thing that we've been talking about a lot in the past several years now is the algal blooms caused by the nutrients from fertilizers that run off from the farms and fields of Ohio, which produce our biggest industry, agriculture.
Yes.
It is a long-term problem. It's been happening for a long time. What is your sense? And yet, the likes of the algal blooms are such that it actually shut down the water system in Toledo like 5 years ago. So it's going to take a long time to address it, but the impacts are immediate at this point, right?
Correct. Yes, we're seeing impacts on water systems in Lake Erie. And I will mention that I know a lot of the focus is on Lake Erie, but there have been 500-mile-long habs on the Ohio River and many of our inland lakes and water.
Grand Lake St. Mary's.
Correct. It's the poster child.
Yeah, exactly. It's completely we shut down for a couple summers.
Yes, and the beaches, unfortunately, remain impacted. But the Department of Natural Resources and others are doing quite a bit to try and do local remediation. What can you do in the short term as far as reservoir management for some of these smaller inland waterways, but then also looking at the long term, what do we do as far as a nutrient diet for Lake Erie or some of these smaller watersheds? I am super excited about the collaboration. I think that's one of the things that is moving us forward, and it has been an advancement since I've started working on this 10 years ago, going to things like the Ohio Ag Nutrient Alliance and the Ohio Agricultural Conservation Initiative, where you have folks around the table that represent the commodity groups, but also the local environmental groups and the universities all saying, okay, we all recognize this is a problem. How can we come to consensus on what makes the best short and long-term impact? So I think there's a lot more unified approach to this, and that's and also under DeWine, that there's some support financially then with the H2 Ohio Fund. So I think we're reaching this really critical mass of we all understand, we're having a better understanding of the problem. We have people that are focused on it and understanding how can we make those differences. I think I heard at a conference yesterday, solving Lake Erie is going to be death by a thousand cuts. There's going to have to be a lot of small actions across a broad area to really see these cumulative improvements. But we've got a group of dedicated folks that are working on that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And joining us now is Jill Ryan. She is the executive director of Freshwater Future. That's a Michigan-based nonprofit organization working to protect the Great Lakes. Welcome to the show, Jill Ryan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, Ohio is in I don't know how many other states there are like Ohio, but Ohio has an industrial piece of this. The PFAS are a big part of that we were talking about, the forever chemicals that we were talking about earlier. It's a huge agricultural state. It's the number one industry in Ohio is agriculture, corn, soybeans. You know, famously, we have the algal blooms in Lake Erie, which also affected Michigan. Also, there's a lot of fracking now in Ohio, and there's questions about whether that is harming the groundwater. There were promises made that it would not. That's unclear at this point. Are there very many other states like Ohio with these three pillars of pollution? Jill?
Unfortunately, I have to say yes.
Okay.
Certainly in Michigan, we're leading the unfortunate designation of the most PFAS contamination sites at this point. We also have, as you said, some blooms in other bays.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Saginaw Bay has some bad blooms. Also, Green Bay in Wisconsin has some bad blooms. So, yes, I think this is a big problem throughout the region. And then, you know, also we're looking at lead and some fracking. Now, I think Ohio, Pennsylvania have kind of unfortunately been leading in that fracking boom.
Mm-hmm.
And we do definitely have some concerns about the long-term impacts of that fracking, because you're essentially sticking a straw down into the aquifer. And when the straw breaks, what happens?
And what about the role of Canada in all of this? Because we share the Great Lakes with Canada.
Absolutely. Canada is, we've been working quite a bit there as well. We're on both sides of the border. And so when we really began working to push for this 40% reduction in phosphorus for Lake Erie, we were working on both sides. And so Canada agreed to that 40% reduction as well. And now there's a lot of work being done to try and implement that. Of course, both states and Ontario have a plan, but we need the plans implemented. And so we're working with Ontario on that as well. And one thing that some recent modeling has shown is that a good deal of the phosphorus coming out of the Detroit River is coming from Lake Huron. And so we have to pay attention up even farther upstream.
And that's coming from agricultural runoff up out of Michigan.
Most likely. I don't think they have done the testing around Lake Huron itself, but that would probably be correct.
And I wanted to ask you, we talked briefly, ever so briefly, about the lead contamination in Flint. How has that issue affected a can-do or a take action on the part of the Michigan legislature? Has it inspired them, or is Michigan already ahead of the eight ball?
So Flint has done a lot to drive Michigan in terms of lead, and so yes, the last governor, Governor Snyder, helped to push forward a piece of legislation that has lowered our standard for lead in drinking water to 12. It also probably more important, though, is that it changed the way that Michigan is doing testing for lead. And so it used to be just you looked at the first thing that came out of the faucet. Now they look at over time what's coming out of a faucet. And that really has done a lot to bring more of the problem to the surface. But of course, that also pushes us toward, oh my gosh, what do these municipalities do? So there's quite a bit of discussion in Michigan around that right now. But we really hope to see other states like Ohio look at this and think about, okay, how do we get ahead of this curve so that we can be looking at how soon do we need to be taking out lead pipes and what do we do in the interim? That law in Michigan also requires that all of our lead pipes be out within 20 years. So it gives us a time frame and something to really shoot at.
Heather Raymond?
Yes, and I'll say that Flint obviously raised awareness of this issue.
Across the country.
And Ohio has taken suit, and there's been additional legislation passed in Ohio that has directed some additional sampling and some more timely notification of those sample results and response with the water system. So I know that there's a lot being done back from when I was working at Ohio EPA prior to coming to here. And there's some new initiatives for lead in schools and trying to do additional testing of those. And I know through the H2 Ohio initiative in Ohio, there's plans to not just do that testing, but have some funds available for remediation if you do find those problems.
Yeah, a lot of things, particularly with the lead issue, it's a house by house issue. It's not something you can address necessarily.
It's what they call the premise plumbing. It's, you know, okay. The faucets in your house or the line that goes from the main line into your house can obviously be older or constructed different ways of different issues that might not be the responsibility of the municipality, but is more on the onus of the homeowner.
Let's take some calls. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the health of Ohio's water, and still with us is Heather Raymond. She's director of the Water Quality Initiative at Ohio State's College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences. Also with us, Jill Ryan. She's executive director of Freshwater Future. It's a Michigan-based nonprofit organization working to protect the Great Lakes, of course, which we share one biggie, Lake Erie. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Charlotte and Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. My question is, I saw on a map on an organization some years ago on the internet that a lot of these chlorofluorocarbons or these fracking compounds in the Eastern Hill Country of Ohio are being pumped down in there, and they're expected to leach into the aquifers that ultimately drift south and even come into the Columbus water source. Hmm. Is there any data on that?
Heather Raymond, do we know what's even in the fracking solutions?
A lot of that is proprietary chemicals, but I will say that the fracking itself and the those processes are pretty heavily regulated. So there are monitoring and there's pressurized tests to make sure that the fluid is going down and not expanding out. And a lot of times these are taking place at, you know, thousands of feet deep, well below our sources of drinking water. But of course, there are concerns. And I think there's, you know, with earthquakes, other things that could be potentially associated with this. And I know
and disrupt
that,
the lines.
Yes. Yeah. So I think there's more work to be done. At this point, I'm not aware of any known contamination incidents from these to at least public drinking water.
What do we know about how far water can travel and how far contaminated water can affect? I mean, are people in Michigan, for instance, I guess, you know, Joe Ryan, are they worried about the fracking in Ohio?
Yes, I would say so. Not necessarily because it might travel all the way, but these aquifers are connected and we don't know the details about how they're connected. One thing that I can tell you is in Michigan, there have been some studies done that show rivers on the west side of the state actually flow underground. Some of the water flows underground way down deep, and the salts end up in Lake Huron. So that's clear across the state underground. Mm. And so those are the types of things that make us very concerned about how all of these contaminants that we're trying to put out of sight, out of mind, can really come back later. And so one of the things we've done in terms of those proprietary fluids is we've worked with an agency that brings together the practitioners on fracking to set up some standards for how they operate. And they have done that. They've passed it for fracking. And one of those things is that they should make those things known, that those are public information. And so we're trying to, but they're voluntary. Right now they're voluntary. And so we're trying to work with states to say, let's make these mandatory. The companies themselves said that this was the right thing to do. So let's move that forward.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Charlotte, for that question. John in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hey, Ann. Love your show.
Thank you
so much for covering the water quality today. I was wondering if either of your guests have any information about the problems with algae in Lake Erie and its relationship to temperature. Obviously, the problems come up in the summertime, so it probably is related to heat. And in particular, to the waste heat that's generated by the two nuclear plants on the lake. Together, they put out over 8,000 megawatts of waste heat. And that's a lot of heat. It's fairly shallow, especially out in the west end of the lake. Does anybody know if those plants are making the algae problem worse?
Heather Raymond?
Well, I can say from a temperature standpoint, the modeling that has been done for Lake Erie has shown that the temperature doesn't necessarily affect whether a bloom occurs or not, but it might impact the initiation. So you might have blooms on Lake Erie that start earlier and extend into later into the fall because the water temperature is reached that point that's optimal for growth for earlier and extended later. I'm not aware of any studies that have particularly looked at blooms around those outfalls.
Or the effect of those plants on the temperature of the water?
Correct. Though theoretically, you could have blooms starting there earlier and persisting there later if those temperature conditions were uniquely different in that smaller sub area. I don't think it's had a huge impact overall, given the size and scale of Lake Erie, but it'd be interesting to look into.
Yeah, forgive me, but it isn't the shallowness of Lake Erie more of a function of the temperature? It is a shallow lake.
Correct. And that will lend to higher mixing, and it will also make that region warm up faster. But other areas, like, you're going to have a stratification. You're going to have warmer portion of almost any lake, even if it is deep. Then that's why you see blooms on other Great Lakes as well and other deeper systems.
Jill Ryan, what is the sense about the federal regulations and how they impact the issues that you're concerned with? we've been talking earlier about how they want to reduce regulations at the federal and at the state level in Ohio, you know, among the Ohio General Assembly. What about Michigan?
Well, we've seen more deregulation in Michigan as well, and in several states across the region. And part of the problem is that, you know, some of that deregulation, that we're already seeing from the federal government in terms of wetlands, for example. So the federal government has now decided they will regulate less wetlands, fewer wetlands. And those are some of the very tools we can use to prevent phosphorus runoff into the lake. So we really have to be careful about that deregulatory piece because those regulations were created to protect us. And so the same with things like the fracking. Do we really not want to know what's in those fluids that could eventually wind up in our drinking water? Don't we want to be able to test for those things? And not just states test, but also individuals be able to do that. So we really think that federal regulatory pieces are important, and so is the state. With H2 Ohio, for example, that's a great start. It would have been great if Governor DeWine would have been given the whole $900 million, but $172 million is good, a good start, and now we need some similar investments, of course, from the federal government.
And I'd like to add that for Ohio, I wouldn't make a blanket statement that they're doing a lot of deregulation. In the terms of HABs, we were the first state in the nation to issue requirements for routine testing for additional treatment, for looking at proactive measures. So I think we are seen as a leader in new HAB regulation to ensure the safety of Ohioans. And I'll say similarly, we're doing more on other fronts. So I know that there's concern over this 2-for-1 rule, but I know at least at Ohio EPA, it's as far as meeting the mission of protecting the water environment people that we're not going to issue a new regulation just because of that rule. We'll find ways to work with the General Assembly to make sure it happens. At least that's from my background as being coming from Ohio EPA.
Well, Jill Ryan, we have to let you go, but I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Jill Ryan is Executive Director of Freshwater Future. That's a Michigan-based nonprofit organization that works to protect the Great Lakes. If you have a question or comment about water quality in Ohio, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Governor DeWine has ordered the State Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Health to investigate the safety of Ohio drinking water. He wants a plan for action by December 1st. We'll see how that goes. But for now, we're just talking about the state of Ohio water today. Still with us is the Director of Water Quality Initiative at the OSU College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences, Heather Raymond. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Heather Raymond, are we better at studying our water now than we were 10, 20 years ago? Have there been advances?
As far as the state of the science, there's a lot of advances analytically. I think the molecular testing is really interesting. I mean, the state of Ohio is looking at the genes that are capable of producing saxitoxins, microcystins, this whole suite of toxins that are impactful to human health. So, and that's a new screening tool that I would have never guessed would have existed a couple of years ago. So, and now we're using it routinely. And so I think there's, on that side, there's a lot. And also on the collaboration, again, that piece, projects where, you know, OSU is working with UT, is working with Bowling Green, and really saying, okay, who's the best minds that are looking at these different niches of the science?
Instead
and
of siloing your work,
correct.
You're collaborating.
Yes, and I think that's just led to some huge advancements.
And for most people, if we're drinking water from our tap, are we safe?
I'd say in Ohio, especially related to HABs, you're probably safer than anywhere else in the country just because we have these set of rules that require the routine monitoring. And on top of that, I think we were innovative, or the state was innovative, in that they also developed treatment technique rules. So even if a water system had never had a source that had impacts from HABs or these toxins, mm-hmm. they were required to like look at their treatment, say, how can I optimize my treatment if this were to start impacting my reservoir or my stream? So being really proactive on what can we do if a problem should start to occur. And I know the problem, though, is a lot of water systems had to invest a lot of money to upgrade their treatment to be capable of dealing with HABs. Toledo's just one example, spending, I think, almost $20 million on upgrades. So this doesn't come without a cost.
Is there a day, do you see coming, when we're going to have to treat all of our water, that we won't have individual wells and that kind of a thing because it's too much of a risk?
I think there's additional concerns on the private side. I think some of our groundwater resources are exceptional. And so there's, if you have a deep well in Ohio, that the water quality is typically good. I would encourage private water owners to do some routine testing, though, just to ensure that they're continually having access to safe drinking water.
Do the filters that we get, like the Britas and that kind of a thing, do they make a difference, or does it just make it taste better?
They can make a difference. The question is, with this growing suite of contaminants that we're concerned with, some of them are good at removing some of those and some of them aren't. And a lot of times the efficacy or how well those work for different types of contaminants, especially I would say for the legacy contaminants, the PFAS, most of those aren't going to work well. But for some other, yes, for bacterial type contaminants, things like that, they work pretty well. It's always good to look at NSF and say, you know, what has this been proven to remove? And there's still some work needed there.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Heather Raymond. She's the Director of Water Quality Initiative at Ohio State's College of Food, Agriculture, and Environmental Sciences. We're talking about water health today, the state of our water in Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513 in Austin and Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Austin.
Hi, Ann. I'm just calling to inquire about what exactly smells in the tap water, because if you take a glass of tap water and smell it compared to a glass of like Brita water, it smells bad. It smells, I mean, you wouldn't notice without the comparison, but yeah, you can tell a difference when you're comparing directly.
I need filtered water now. I prefer filtered water. But what is that, Heather Raymond? Can't be anything that's dangerous.
There are
it?
A variety of things that we would call taste and odor compounds. There's things like jasmine or MIB. These are naturally occurring substances that can give a earthy or a musty odor that sometimes it's water systems do spend a lot of money trying to remove those, but they're generally harmless chemicals, but it might be difficult. There's other things, though. Chlorine, sometimes if you have a lot of chlorine in your water, people take offense to that. A traditional carbon filter can get rid of a lot of those types of chemicals. And also if you have groundwater, sometimes you have kind of a sulfury type odor. And again, that's not something that could be harmful, but it's might be off-putting.
All right. So thanks a lot for that call. We treat our water with fluoride, right?
In most cases,
In most cases, yes. Do the filtering systems like the Britas, does that take that out?
I'm uncertain on that. So I'm unfortunately not versed on the fluoridation issues.
There's things we put in our water, though.
Correct.
To make it healthier?
Yes, there's long studies been done with the Dental Association of how that addition has really single-handedly helped reduce cavities and improved oral health. So I think the weight of evidence, as far as I'm aware of the situation, is that the fluoridation does the benefits outweigh any negatives.
You were talking about earlier about one of the biggest improvements in how you study water is the collaboration, the collaborative nature of it now that you have Farm Bureau with the universities, with, cities all working together and the state. And I'm wondering, because Ohio has these kind of these three legs, the fracking issue, the agricultural runoff issue, and also the industrial issue, which creates the PFAS, these forever chemicals. Do you see a sense of collaboration among those three entity, those three causes?
Maybe on the environmental side more than others, because I think they're looking at, public health impacts as a whole. Unfortunately, I think there are some silos. I think in the technology aspects, the folks that are working on how do you treat the water to remove these chemicals, a lot of the treatment technologies are similar. So those people are talking. Probably more needs to be done. In many cases, the causes of those are so different and the solutions are so different that I don't know as much if the collaboration would make as much sense, but it's a good question. And in my role as Water Quality Initiative Director, my primary focus is going to be on HABs and some of the state priorities. But looking at the PFAS and some of these other emerging contaminants, Legionella is a big one that's recently had impacts on the local in Columbus and some of the hospitals. I think I'm going to try and take a broad look at that.
What about the climate change that's afoot? We just were talking earlier this week about rainwater overflow, sewer overflow, and the contaminants that are associated with that. What are your thoughts about how the climate change is going to affect us going forward with these challenges?
Well, that's a huge question as far as especially the timing of rainfall events and the severity of spring storms. I think the agricultural community in particular, with 40% of our crops not planted in some portions of the state this year, we're really heavily hit by that. And I think that's understanding how our practices that we put in place not just address the current conditions, but can recognize that we could have these stronger storms and this could have broader impacts from both the CSO standpoint or the agriculture, how nutrients are flowing off the landscape. So I think that does pose challenges. I know some of the modeling work that we're doing is looking at different scenarios and if this climate is changing or there are weather patterns that are changing, how is that going to impact these other issues?
Is there going to be more demand for the freshwater of the Great Lakes going forward? Do you see any issue there?
The quantity issues I'm less familiar with, but I know that there, it does periodically come up where people are like, wow, this is a great resource. And, the other states that are more limited in those water resources have looked to us. I know we have some pretty strong agreements international with Canada on the compact and what we do with our water. But even within the state of Ohio, I know the Grand Lake St. Mary's, they wanted to drill wells so they could avoid use of that reservoir. But where the wells were on the other side of the Lake Erie-Ohio River divide. So they ran into problems there. So I think there are some emerging issues that especially with the more demand in the future, that we're going to have to be cognizant of.
We've talked mostly about the impact on the land and on the water tables and so forth. But is there anything unique about Ohio, the land of Ohio and the way it's formed and the way it was formed, that affects our ability to protect it? The topography,
we have high density agriculture in Northwest Ohio. We have a lot of legacy sites. I think, I talked to my counterparts in California and they're dealing with very similar issues. I mean, and then they have coastal issues, so right. Marine issues. So I'd almost say in some cases they may have it worse. I don't necessarily see a unique aspect of Ohio. I think a lot of what we're doing with is both national and global issues. And I've partnered with folks at the Cawthorn Institute New Zealand, Natural Resource Council Canada, and UC Davis and SUNY because of these issues being very similar. And we need to reach out to others that are doing work in in various areas.
Is there a way to approach, when it comes to the algal bloom issue, is there a sustainable approach? It's not going to, over time, it'll change how we do agriculture.
Very good questions. I know there's a lot of funding going towards this, a lot of work on how can we implement there's no silver bullet. How can we work through a suite of practices to try and make incremental changes to this? So I think there is progress. I do also have to point out that Lake Erie is the walleye capital of the world. It's a very productive system. We need some nutrients going into there. Obviously.
We need to feed the fish.
Right. We need to feed the fish. However, obviously, we're way out of balance at this point. So, but recognizing that nutrients aren't necessarily evil, you know, there is benefit to that. I'm so excited because I really think we have money, we have funding, we have people that are committed to working on this across the board, collaboration. So I think what's going to be hard is it is going to take time. And we're not going to, even though it seems like $60 million or $170 million is a lot. Plus, there's also money coming in from Farm Bureau, other programs, NRCS, lots of, you know, where we're looking at all the funding pools we can to help solve this problem. But it is something. It took a while to get to this point. I think it's going to take a while to prove. And I really want to say one final thing, though, is remember, Lake Erie was deemed dead. And the Cuyahoga River was on fire.
Right.
So, I just look through my lifetime, what amazing accomplishments have happened, and know that, you know, we fixed it once. I think we can fix it again.
Bill Mitch, one of the founders of the Wetland Research Park here at Ohio State, he's now down in Florida, but he's talked about how some of these blooms are going to become self-perpetuating, that there are some forever blooms out there. They're worried that we're not going to be able to make them go away just because of the nature of where they're at and what they do.
And he's dealing with Okeechobee, which is a little bit different issue. I will say the good thing about Lake Erie is the residence time in the Western Basin is only like a month or so. So the water that comes in there then gets flushed out quite quickly. So that helps us as far as, we've seen it in drought years. When we have less water flowing into Lake Erie and less nutrients, then instantly the bloom is decreased. And it may not even be a problem. You might have no bloom at all.
Uh-huh.
So I think, I think that's not an issue for Lake Erie, but for systems like Grand Lake St. Mary's that we've seen the concentrations of toxins go up. It's a smaller system and it's more self-perpetuating. So in some instances, I think that could be the case. I don't think it's the case for Lake Erie. I think it's going to be harder for some of our inland lakes.
And as far as the concerns about the toxins from the algae, from the runoff, from the nutrients, there's a question about whether they can hurt us even if we don't go in the water.
There's been so they don't volatilize. There has been some research on aerosolization. So, like, basically, if you're jet skiing or doing something, you get these water droplets and you can get them in. The research I've seen to date has shown that that's not a primary pathway. It's really accidental ingestion. When you are in the water, swimming, recreating, and you're getting it, exposed that way. That's one of the reasons why we see more dog deaths and more acute impacts to animals.
Because they're going in and drinking it.
Because they'll eat anything. Yeah. They see this green muck on the side of the beach and they think it's awesome. And they eat it up and then that's a problem. So I think that from the education standpoint, that's important if you see green stuff, please don't let your dog eat it. I would say that when in doubt, stay out is another good just general principle. But I think, we have seen some human health potential impacts. I think we're working on more tests for serum sampling, things like that. So if there are exposure incidents in the future that we can do some human testing to see, well, was that gastrointestinal distress or other things that this person is experiencing is related to a cyanotoxin exposure or the fact that they ate a bad coleslaw that morning.
Right. And then the toxins that we are talking about, there tend to be more neural toxins, right?
There's two suites. I'd say the ones that are up in Lake Erie, microcystins, are a hepatotoxin. So they're more of a liver toxin.
Okay.
But the saxitoxin, some of the others that are seen in Ohio, but at a lower frequency, those are neurotoxins. And some of the animal deaths have been more associated with the neurotoxin. We say if your dog eats something green and it dies within an hour, it's probably a neurotoxin. If it dies the next day, it was probably hepatotoxin.
Huh. Okay. The liver. Heather Raymond, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Heather
Raymond, the show.
Director of the Water Quality Initiative at Ohio State's College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.